never really got the appeal of birding until a few years ago on a hike through a forest in Oklahoma. When I looked up and saw a flash of red feathers more brilliant than anything I thought could exist in nature. Based on a post-hike Google search, I'm pretty sure it was a scarlet tanager, although no picture online could do it justice. And while I haven't seen one since, that experience has left me forever on the lookout, because you just never know when some amazing creature might be perched in the treetops above your head. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Birders call experiences like mine the spark, the sight of something special enough to keep you looking for more. These days, devoted birders are encouraged to log their finds into this crowdsourcing app called eBird, where discoveries can be accessed by scientists and by fellow animal lovers. But as my guest has learned, there are pros and cons to sharing rare finds. What inspires fledgling birders to value and spend more time in the wilderness can easily leave fragile ecosystems overrun. Kevin Wen is an author of the novel New Waves and is features editor at The Verge, where you can read his article, A Once-in-a-Lifetime Bird. Kevin, welcome to Think.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris.
What was the spark for Chris Michaud, who is the birder at the center of this story?
I know exactly what it was. He was on a date. And he and this woman, Gemma, who was seeing at the time, she's an ornithologist. So she thought, why don't I, share my life with this guy, show him some birds. So they went out to kind of like a marsh in New Hampshire. And I think as soon as he saw, an ibis, glossy ibis, really common birds in an area, he just like couldn't stop thinking about them even on the rest of the date. So that was his spark moment.
And so even when a lot of other things in his life were falling apart, right, like his sobriety, his health, his relationship, he felt like birding helped to ground him, and he started making it a regular thing.
Yeah, I had a lot of pretty deep conversations with Chris about his life. He used to be, in a screamo band in Maine, and later in life he decided to get sober, and then later he had cancer. And birding was kind of the thing that got him through it, partly too, because when he got sober, he realized that, he used to spend all his time in bars and he could no longer do that. So he spent his time outside observing the wilderness and walking around. And then later he got stage 4 Hodgkin's lymphoma. And when he was doing chemo, he couldn't do so much walking around outside, but he could still get out there, see some birds. And I think that was really revitalizing for him.
Yeah, and during the chemo, I guess he would be knocked flat for days on end, but the first couple of days he felt pretty good because of the steroids, and so he would sort of plan his birding life around that.
I know. It was really quite funny when he told me about it. He's one of those people who's, when they talk about their cancer, like maybe in hindsight a little bit, but he's very funny about it. So he's like, I'd be pumped full of toxic chemicals, and for 2 days I would feel great, and I'd go birding. And he was like, and then I would do a week of feeling like hell. So
as he got more and more into birding as a hobby, Chris installed eBird on his phone. Tell us a little bit about the app and how it kind of enhances, I guess, the experience of bird watching.
Yeah, eBird was I was not a birder until I started working on this piece. But it's a pretty cool little app. It's made by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And basically, it's kind of a mashup between, I would say, like, Goodreads, where you log all your books that you're reading. Here you log all your birds, but this one's a little more active. It's kind of a little bit like Pokemon Go in that it helps you identify what you're looking at outdoors. So if you're, where I live in Brooklyn, if I'm walking around Prospect Park and I open eBird, it'll show me, very likely birds that are in the area, and I can tap on the app and it'll log it in the service.
I'm glad you mentioned Brooklyn, because all of us who live in cities of any size sort of assume that we have to go out of town in order to engage in this, but there are birds everywhere.
There really are. I mean, when I started birding a little bit, and I'm not an avid birder, I went with some friends to Prospect Park, and I think we walked around for 45 minutes, and I think we saw maybe 12, 13 different kinds of birds. That quickly. And so it was very thrilling to me, especially as someone that like didn't do it that often, because, like a beautiful like red bird would go by and my friend would be like, oh, that's a cardinal. They're they're around all the time. But it was still thrilling to me as a newbie.
And there's also this companion app, right, called Merlin, the point of which is helping people know what birds they're looking at.
Yeah, so it's like all part of this suite of apps that the Cornell Lab makes. There's like Merlin, and there's like a handful of others. Actually, I can't remember the name of it, but it's brand new. And it can actually identify birds from like the bird call, like their song. So like the little clip you played earlier, if you plugged it into this part of eBird, it might be able to spit out exactly what you were looking at.
Oh, that's fantastic. So how long have eBird and its companion apps been in wide use?
Yeah, I think they hit 20 years. I think it was a 20th anniversary in May. And eBird actually started out as like a website that you could log on to and you could like mark your birds later. And then eventually it became an app using geolocation. And then, you know, like all these Shazam-like features are a little more recent. But what I think is kind of funny about the history of eBird is you can kind of chart the progression of the internet through it, you know, because 20 years ago, we were really looking at websites. 10 years ago, you know, like everything became mobile and geolocation-based. And, you know, now they're all into big data, and that's helping fuel a lot of their research. So, yeah, it's kind of cool.
And it was a National Science Foundation grant that paid to get these apps built and developed. The point has always been some kind of scientific evidence collection, right?
Yes. The Cornell Lab is, you know, they're definitely interested in, you know, having amateur birders, like, get out there, engage with nature. But their core mission is to create, you know, a wealth of information that can be used for research. A lot of it, obviously, in the field of ornithology, but maybe surprising to some, maybe not. A lot of it is used for like ecology and climate change research as well. And that's become the more urgent use of a lot of this data.
Kevin, do these apps work everywhere in the world, or are they sort of specific to the United States?
That's a great question. As far as I know, they work everywhere in the world. Yeah, there may be some countries where, you know, it isn't available, but definitely like I talk to the Cornell Lab a lot, like a lot of Latin America, Colombia, like places like that, they have a lot of special projects in. And I guess South America has like a greater diversity of large birds. It's very exciting both to the Cornell Lab and to amateur birders.
Is it fair game for a birder to log an animal that they have heard but not been able to spot?
Yeah, well, the birding world is funny. I feel like I only scratched the surface in researching this piece. There's just so much funny etiquette around it. So I think some people would say that if you just heard a bird and it like came up in the app, you definitely need to spot it before you can log it. Other people, they say that's like a little more fungible. So it really depends on who you talk to.
All right. So what does it take to get access to that aggregated data that eBird is pulling in from users all over?
As far as I know, you can just hit up the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. The idea is that they make all of this research widely available to people who need it. So I think it's as simple as probably reaching out to the lab, which is very cool. You know, we think about like all the things in our lives that collect massive and massive amounts of data, you know, like Facebook, Google. And what do they use that data for? Well, they sell it to advertisers, right? So it was really fascinating to me to see something like the Cornell Lab use all those same techniques for what I would argue is a much more wholesome and worthwhile goal.
So like Big Bird Seed is not cashing in on this. This is just for science.
Yeah, as far as I know, I'm sure there's probably a stipulation if you get this research data for free from the Cornell Lab, you can't turn around and sell it or commercialize it. So.
Okay, so 20 years in use is a good chunk of time. What sorts of patterns in bird sightings have scientists been able to chart based on eBird reports?
Yeah, this was an interesting thing to find. I think maybe I knew this rationally, but it's funny when you talk to researchers and academics, because I think in my brain, you know, climate change is very urgent and all scientists are in a lab trying to figure out how to solve climate change. But that's not really how it works, right? Everyone has very incremental projects, starting weather patterns and systems. And a lot of it is, yeah, honestly, I talked to a lot of people at the Cornell Lab, and a lot of the research just like, it went over my head, you know? But everything just tells us another signal about what's happening to the world. Climate change is a systems problem. So it's not even just understanding what's up with birds, right? Everything that eBird data tells us, tells us about the ecology or the health of, the ecosystem of insects or wind patterns, temperature changes, things like that. And all of that stuff adds up incrementally to a better understanding of what's happening to the planet.
That idea of a systems problem is really interesting. In other words, it's not necessarily so useful to isolate one set of data points without looking at others that might surround it.
Yeah, it's fun talking to climate researchers because you imagine they would be like the most panicked about what's happening to the Earth. And they're kind of the most collected about it because they just understand that it's a really complex, sophisticated problem. It's probably what makes it exciting to them as well. But, their pursuit is not necessarily solutions. How do we stop the planet from getting hotter? They just like want to understand it better. And from that, I think the solutions spring.
And eBird's project director, Chris Wood, who is also the director of the Center for Avian Population Studies, can't help but, as you note in the piece, resort to cliches when explaining why birds are a particularly powerful indicator of the health of the planet, right? That there's a reason people sent canaries into coal mines to test the air.
Yeah, it was really funny because he said that. I was like, I'm really sorry, like, to use this cliche, but like, birds are, like a canary in the coal mine. And I just thought, wow, is Earth one large coal mine?
Yeah, but birds may be the most vulnerable, but eventually, this kind of damage is coming for all of us.
Yes, exactly. It was just like really interesting as I researched this piece, which. When I started, I really just wanted to talk about this like cool little app that was like Goodreads but for birds. And then the more I read and read about it, like the more I felt like it told us about what's going on with the planet, what's going on with, big changes in our society. Sort of like birds as a lens for everything.
Has the app changed over time? Like, has the functionality evolved a whole lot?
They do keep it pretty simple, which I actually quite like. The design of eBird has not changed drastically over the past few years, but sort of like I mentioned, they just keep adding pretty cool new features. There's one called Birdcast that like is able to predict I think wind patterns, and you can like see that. So it's like turning itself into a weather app. But otherwise, they keep it pretty simple, which is nice. I don't know about you, but I know every time. Like a Instagram makes an update, I get very confused and very lost. And
Right.
it happens every 3 months.
Do I really need or want this update is always the question, right?
Yeah. And granted, I think the impetus for, our social platforms updating all the time is better ways to track our data and sell us more ads. And eBird doesn't have that incentive, which is great.
So, Kevin, I love the way scientists in a whole lot of fields have, found ways to give regular people a chance to contribute to scientific knowledge, but regular people without advanced knowledge of ornithology could make mistakes, right? How do scientists who draw data from eBird reports deal with the errors that might crop up from app users who mean well but just aren't experts yet?
Yeah, I mean it's a little controversial in this world, so I've definitely talked to people on both sides of this. But the way eBird works is, usually when you're in an area with a lot of birds that are common in the area, it kind of shows you those first. But if you're really convinced that you're seeing something that's a little unusual, which definitely happens, you can log it. And eBird actually has a set of volunteer moderators that actually look at every kind of anomalous entry. And in a lot of cases, these volunteers will actually reach out to you, the eBird user that logged the rare bird, to just verify, what you saw. Like, do you have a photo? Like, describe it. Which is like a very cool system, I think, to keep track of, to make sure things are accurate. At the same time, I talked to someone who has been doing, bird records for over 20 years. Actually, maybe I think it was closer to 40 years. And he didn't have a whole lot of trust in eBird data. He just thought there was too many people doing it, too many amateurs, not doing enough verification. And then Cornell Lab's response to that was, the way big data works is that like you just know that something like 90% of your data is reliable, and you just make sure you take into account that 10% that you know may be a little inaccurate. And if you collect enough data, a lot of those anomalies that are wrong or are outliers, they just kind of scrub out in the grand scheme of things.
So if you and I were birding on the same stretch of beach or patch of woods and we saw the same bird and logged it into eBird, is there any way for the app to know that that's one bird and not two?
There is no way for the app to know that, but it's also, it's less that the it's counting like the number of birds in the area, and just, confirming that there are those birds in the area, if that makes sense.
What do we know, though, about the disappearance of birds from the landscape in North America?
Yeah, I mean, the Cornell Lab published this study, I think 3 years ago, that had identified that, just a massive, massive number of birds had been lost over the past 3 decades. I think it was like a billion birds lost, or 3 billion, I think. And it's just like one of those numbers I'm actually having a hard time remembering exactly, because it's just such an unfathomable amount of loss. So yeah, and obviously, like, that's a huge sign of declining ecosystems. We would hope to see, bird populations growing, not shrinking. And sort of as we were talking about earlier, everything being a systems problem in nature, a decline in birds means like a decline in plants and a decline in insects. And yeah, and it just all is like adding up, and we're trying to figure out what it adds up to.
So, Chris, the subject of your story usually likes to go birding alone, but what is the kind of social component to eBird, the app?
Yeah, you can definitely have friends on it. It's kind of interesting. It's less of a social network. And again, like, things like Twitter, Facebook, they're always encouraging you to make connections, because that strengthens the platform as a targeting tool for advertisers. You kind of find like a lot of restraint when those features in eBird, because they don't have those incentives. The really interesting thing to them is the birds. But just in terms of social stuff, like, the birding community is very social. Actually, they use things like Twitter and Facebook groups a lot to talk about birds. Bird photography is shared quite widely on Instagram. So yeah, it's kind of like wherever the people are, the bird people are there too.
So this is really fascinating. There is like a particular etiquette to how certain birds get logged into the app or not. Why might a user in New York City choose not to mark down the sighting of a snowy owl in Central Park?
Yeah, owls are a very controversial bird in a way. What's actually kind of funny is I think it was three or four different people I talked to described owls as charismatic birds to explain their popularity. They all use that word, charismatic, which I found very funny. But yeah, so owls, particularly snowy owls in Central Park in New York City, tend to, when spotted, cause massive, massive droves of people to show up. This phenomenon in birding lingo is called twitching, which I find adorable. But yeah, it's sort of just because people are so charmed by snowy owls, they show up in droves in all sorts of weather. And New York is a very dense place. So when hundreds, sometimes thousands of people show up, which is really like the number of people that come out, like, some people take flash photography of the birds, which is not good for them. And just being around that many people, I think, is kind of troubling for the ecosystem, even in a place like Central Park. So, I was told by some friends who bird, it's like, if you see an owl, like, you just don't log in eBird, because you don't want eBird to notify other users that the owl's in the area.
Is that automatic that other users get notified, or is there some kind of setting where you can report it through the app but not make it public?
Yeah, there's a very cool feature that happens. The big one is it's actually an email that goes out from the American Birding Association. And they send out an email every morning, I believe, that tells you about rare birds in your area. And there's like a whole leveling system for them. So, like, the story that I wrote is about a red wing that showed up in Maine, and that was a level 4, which is a a very rare instance, and it's out of five, this system. So this email goes out telling people that a rare bird is in the area, and that's when people start showing up. And there are stories of people driving like 5, 10, 15 hours to come see a rare bird. Some people hop on planes to see a bird if it's exciting enough. So yeah, once this email goes out, it really triggers a lot of people to show up.
Okay, let's hear what a red wing sounds like. All right, very sweet little song, Kevin. And to be clear, a red wing is a sweet little bird, but it's hardly the most spectacular species somebody might come upon out in the world. They look a lot, I guess, like young robins before their full coloring comes in. Why was, and it was Chris, the subject of your story, who found this one, why was he so excited to see a red wing in Maine?
Yeah, so he was living kind of in the boonies in Maine, and he just looked out his window and he thought what he saw was, like a weird robin is what he described it as. And it was kind of gray and, like a little ugly, in his words. He just, thought it was like kind of strange. And later he texted someone at the Cornell lab who actually identified it as a red wing to him. And Chris was telling me this story really excitedly and breathlessly, and I had to stop him. And I was just like, what's a red wing? Like, it doesn't sound that exciting. And it turns out it's just a bird that you never see, or very rarely see in North America. But what's really funny is that they're extremely common birds in like the UK and in parts of Scandinavia. And what had happened is, a weather system had launched this bird in flight across the Atlantic, and it had ended up in Maine. But it was so fascinating to hear, like it wasn't the bird itself that was exciting. It was sort of the context of the bird. So a red wing may not be exciting if you live in the UK, but if you live in Maine, it's maybe the most exciting bird you can see. I don't know. Chris seems so excited.
So he did not want his little community overrun by twitching birders, right? And even if they didn't disturb the locals, all that drop everything travel sort of has a cost to the environment, which is ironic.
Yes, very ironic. The idea that you would go observe nature by getting on a plane and burning a lot of jet fuel, which is obviously not great for the environment, is a funny irony in the birding world. To be fair, I don't think that many people get on the plane, but a lot of people hop in their cars, their combustion engine cars, which is also not great for our planet. But yeah, I did. It was funny when Chris was telling me he was worried that like hundreds of people would show up in his backyard all of a sudden. I thought he was exaggerating, but the twitching phenomenon, it's real.
Have you actually seen a horde of birders descend on an area?
I've been close to, actually, I think it was a snowy owl. I just happened to be, this was years ago, but I happened to be around Central Park at night, and there were just a tons of people taking flash photography in the park. And I just assumed maybe, I don't know, someone, there was like a movie premiere or someone famous was there. But no, just tourists were just chasing around this poor little owl.
So Chris did not put his red wing on eBird. He did call the local chapter of the Audubon Society. How did the society respond?
With total enthusiasm and excitement. The staff was at Maine Audubon. He was telling me he was visiting. So this was in 2020. So we're kind of still in the pandemic, and he was seeing his family for Christmas in Massachusetts, and he got this email about the red wing, and he confirmed it, and he was just like, I gotta leave Christmas. I gotta go see this bird.
Wow.
So they're very excited. But yeah, so Chris, he decided not to log the bird because he didn't want to log the ABA rarity email. But he did want, some naturalists, some scientists, some researchers to come and confirm what he was looking at and have it logged somewhere for the sake of science.
It is interesting, Kevin. I've always liked obsessives. I'm not obsessive about any particular thing, I don't think, but there's something I think exciting about finding other people who share your unusual obsession. Is that part of the appeal, do you think, of birding?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people are looking for community, and they're always finding a thing to center that community on. So I saw that a lot with birders. They truly are obsessive. The times I've gone to the park, it's kind of fun. I go with a friend that birds a couple times a week, and she's always running into people, and you can identify them pretty quickly by the binoculars around their neck. And they're just always striking conversation and telling people about what they saw or what they hope to see. And these are often strangers, and there's just this immediate connection that they have.
It's funny that so many people seem to have come to birding in recent years through this app because some observers think it's our dependence on technology that's played a role in making people want to do it.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because I think, a lot of outdoor activities have become a little more popular, especially in the pandemic, but the funny irony of this is that, people want to have less screen time. They want to look at their phone less. But I think eBird is actually an app on a phone has helped contribute to the popularity of birding because at the same time, it makes it easier and more accessible. And, the act of it is very familiar, like, if you know how to log a book on Goodreads, like the concept of eBird is very easy for you as well.
And of course, these amazing cell phones we have now make it easier as well, right? You can get that audio recording, you can take a photo if you're lucky enough, and the cameras are pretty good on most phones these days.
Yeah, that's actually a huge part of it. Bird photography has like a long history. I know this because I have an uncle who has an extraordinarily complicated setup with this camera for taking pictures of birds. He posts to his Instagram that has like 60 followers, which I find very adorable. But yes, like we have these like powerful computers in our pockets, and I don't know, I just love that people are using them to spend time in nature.
So people are using the app kind of in real time rather than making notes somewhere and going home and logging. This is probably happening as they spot these things.
Yeah, because I think if you're birding in before the era of the smartphone, you're usually logging things in a notebook and going home, and then 20 years ago you could send it to eBird, the website, and then before 20 years ago, you're probably just keeping records for yourself if you were just an amateur birder. So there's just a lot more immediate satisfaction in logging things in eBird, and actually. A lot of the birders I talk to, like they just know the app keeps an account of how many unique species you've seen. So a lot of people knew their counts immediately. So there's kind of a, I don't think it's competitive, but there's kind of like a progress and a leveling up and a slight gamification of the experience that I think is appealing for some people.
So for actual ornithologists, the work of studying birds can be less gamified, less convenient. You spent some time with Chris's ex-girlfriend, Gemma, who, as you mentioned, is an ornithologist. What is a typical day like for her out in the field?
Yeah, I spoke with her and I didn't know any of this before we had spoken. But she's actually at the Cornell lab now, and in the summer she studies tern colonies, and she wants to study their diets. And the best way to study a bird's diet is to identify, to collect samples of the bird's feces. And the way she does that is she basically goes out to the tern colonies, lightly disturbs them. And she's wearing like a big old parka, and they just poop all over her for like days on end. And she collects those samples and brings them back to the lab. And this is like not originally what I wanted to interview her about, but I just had so many questions about her lifestyle of just getting pooped on all day long. So.
And you wanted to know, like, is there some special scientific jacket that you can purchase on some specialized website? And the answer is no, it's just an old coat.
It's just old coats that you probably, don't want to wear out in front of humans. So.
Kevin, you've mentioned Prospect Park and Central Park. It's interesting, the notorious Amy Cooper, Christian Cooper confrontation happened there a couple of years ago when this white woman called the police on a black man who asked her to put her dog on a leash so the dog wouldn't scare birds away. That's a story we won't rehash in the moment, but a lot of people at the time were surprised that this was a hobby for a guy like Christian Cooper. Turns out birding is probably a lot less white and less old and even less male a pastime than a lot of folks assume.
Yeah, it was really fun talking to birders. because, they did apologize a little bit about, it having this reputation in this past for being very old, male, and white. But I think there's just a burgeoning community of people that looks very different, just much more diverse, especially like a lot of young Black birders in particular, but also Latino and Asian birders as well. It's just becoming a more popular activity for young people, and also just, a more diverse population of people as well.
And now Christian Cooper is about to have his own show, right?
Yeah, it was a couple months ago. National Geographic confirmed that he's going to have a show about birding. So I think he's traveling all around the world talking about birds, which I think is his dream, as far as I know.
Yeah, it sounds like great work if you can get it. So what explanation did ornithologists have for how that little red wing that a Christmas show saw in Maine, how it might have found its way there if it's basically a European species?
Yeah, I'm no expert on weather patterns or, but the way it was explained to me is that a low pressure system, I guess it went from clockwise to counterclockwise and just scooped this red wing up while it was in flight, probably migrating, and just like hurled it across the Atlantic, which seems like such a crazy and tremendous journey. But, I think this thing actually, because of climate change, is becoming more and more common. Yeah, common wind changes are caused by climate change. Maybe not a great sign for the health of our planet, but it is making birds show up in stranger places than usual.
It is really interesting to try and picture that. In my mind, it's like an animation where this little bird has no idea what's happening and through forces beyond its control ends up literally a continent away from where it might have intended to go.
Yeah, I mean these poor birds. I have actually a very similar imagination when it comes to like what happened there. It almost feels like comical, but these things are getting more and more common, so.
So another irony, I guess, about eBird is that some of these rarest verifiable sightings get birders extremely excited. Ornithologists are less interested in those anomalies, right, than in the broader kind of more predictable patterns that the app might reveal.
Yeah, this is kind of the funny conflict, I think, between, amateur birders on the whole and researchers. Researchers are trying to look for the things that happen every day. Like they want to see people logging every little robin they see because, sort of as we were talking about earlier, the scale of eBird data to be useful, it collects a lot of, collects a lot of data and there's going to be a lot of noise in it. So the solution to that is to have as much scale as possible. The funny thing is that birders, when I went out with that friend in Prospect Park, she was most excited about trying to find something she'd never seen before or not seen as commonly. Robins were not very interesting to her. But it's actually, those outliers, the really rare birds, the red wing that got thrown off course, that might tell us something a little bit about the weather system, but it's not actually great data. That's kind of the stuff that researchers are most likely to discard as an outlier and an anomaly and something that doesn't exactly tell us enough about what's happening to the weather system.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Brian is calling us from Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Brian.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is the red-winged blackbird discussion brought it to mind. I have noticed, I'm in my 60s, I've noticed over the years certain bird species seem to have shown up in Fort Worth, like the black vulture, Mississippi kites, and most lately, brown-headed cowbirds have appeared at some of my bird feeders. Are we seeing an influx, movements of different birds through different environmental zones? And I'll just hang up and let you answer that or discuss that. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Brian. We'll remind everybody that Kevin's a writer and not an ornithologist, but what do you know about the sort of movement of different birds to new habitats, Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to that specific scenario, but I mean, anecdotally, that sounds like what we're hearing. I think it's interesting. The birds that all the bird stuff that I encountered in researching this piece just led to the idea that like the world is changing very quickly. And researchers are just trying to figure out, are these just natural migration patterns that are changing? Is it just what regular weather systems that are changing. But they're all in agreement that there's some kind of an acceleration of this because of climate change. So yeah, it would not surprise me at all if new species of birds were becoming more common in different places and moving around.
Do the people who run this app and sort of keep it maintained, do they think that participating in birding in this way causes people to be a little more tied in to how the environment and the climate is changing?
Yeah, actually, Chris Wood, the director of eBird, I was kind of surprised to hear him say this, but he thinks the most important part of eBird is just like creating a world where regular people have a connection to their environment, so if they're excited about rare birds and that's not necessarily useful to research or climate change scientists, that's okay with him. He just wants people to have a connection to the world and not feel apathetic about what's happening to it.
We have an email here from Mary Kate who wants to know, is the eBird app a better way for a backyard birder to observe and contribute than the annual Audubon backyard bird count? Do you have an opinion on that?
I don't have an opinion. I'm sure the answer to that some very, politically correct birders say you should just do both. There's a little bit of competition, I think, between various Audubon chapters and the Cornell Lab that I was only scratching the surface of. But yeah, I think you can do both. Also, if you've just never used eBird, I would just recommend it's free. You can just download it. It's on, iPhone and Android. And I think it's a neat little app. I found it really impressive, honestly, that it was this app made by, Cornell, which is obviously a well-resourced place, but it's not a big tech company,
How did you find Chris Michaud, by the way, who has such a unique and yet relatable story when it comes to birding?
Yeah, it's actually funny. I just heard about him through a friend of a friend, and it really actually came out of a discussion about sobriety. So we weren't even talking about birding at the get-go, and it was the pandemic, and we were talking about funny pandemic stories, and someone was like, "Oh yeah, I have this friend. Like, he saw this like very rare bird in his backyard, but he's like afraid to tell people about it because like all the birders would show up." And like after researching this article for some time now, that doesn't seem preposterous. But in the moment, it seemed preposterous to me that a bunch of people would just show up to rural Maine to see a bird. And it turns out that Chris's fear was extremely well-founded.
I would think of birding as being a pretty meditative pastime, but it sounds like people get really, really excited about this. Is there sort of a balance between those two valences?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think that not everyone is, the birding community, it is broad, it is diverse, and I think there are a lot of different incentives there. So there are the people that would hop on a plane to go see a rare bird immediately, but I do think there's obviously a lot more casual birders. I actually have a friend who doesn't even use eBird. She was the only person I talked to that wasn't interested in logging things. And that, because to her, she just really wants to not look at her phone. She really wants to be detached and just be in nature. So I think, there's like a large spread of what people want out of birding or what they find satisfying. But there is a large enough population of people that are very intense about twitching that you have to be concerned about it.
So, Kevin, I know we brought you on to talk about birding, but I do want to talk a little, if you don't mind, about this novel that you wrote called New Waves, explores internet culture and the tech industry. Tell us a little bit about that and what you wanted to look at in a way that no one had before.
Yeah, so I'm a, you know, I work at a tech website called The Verge, and there are certain kinds of stories I feel like you can tell through journalism, and I think there are stories you can tell that are a little bit, muddier, that are still getting at other kinds of truth through fiction. So that's what was really exciting to me about trying to write a novel. But yeah, this one is it's about a friendship, it's about grief, it's a lot about race. But yeah, it's about two people who work at a startup and kind of all the problems they run into together as, two people who feel very marginalized in their workplace.
we've just started to talk in this country, it feels like, about the ways that race intersects with the tech world, and typically not in ways that are favorable to folks who aren't sort of white and young and male.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because there are tech is so specific, but obviously it's so powerful right now. And, you know, I think I wanted to write something that didn't necessarily, you know, condemn the industry or just, you know, but sort of understood why it is the way it is and what it's like to kind of muddle through it at times. You know, I'm Asian American, and one of the characters, the point of view character is also Vietnamese American. And it's interesting because Asian people are not necessarily underrepresented, especially in engineering staffs. But what's it like when you're not East Asian? You know, I'm Southeast Asian, and there's a whole lot less of us in tech. And then what is it like if you're not an engineer, you know, and you're someone that answers emails, customer service emails? So it was playing a little bit on maybe what we think of like the makeup of the tech workforce looks like and how we navigate through that.
And the story is a lot about sort of disconnection online. Do you think it landed with people in a particular way that maybe you hadn't intended because lots of folks were reading this during the pandemic?
Yeah, the hardcover came out March of 2020, which was, you know, maybe not the best time in some ways, although I think a lot of people were at home reading. It's kind of funny. There's one part of the book that a lot of people would screenshot and send around. And I just had this line, and it's like there's a scene where some engineers are looking at, you know, some user data and like how something is spreading across the country and like how things are going viral. And I said it looked like a pandemic spreading across the country. So it seemed very prescient and maybe like a little too close to home in the early days of the pandemic when we wanted to not think about it as much as we were.
I guess it must be good as someone who focuses on tech but also loves to write to realize we haven't lost our appetite for novels.
Yeah, I think, you know, people are always hemming and hawing about the death of the book, the death of fiction. But I don't know, I walk into my local independent bookstore and I just feel like I'm more excited each time I walk in. There's just so many new exciting books. And I think, you know, the kinds of people that can get published are, you know, increasingly from surprising and marginalized backgrounds. So we're just hearing stories that we haven't heard before. And I don't know, I think it's just a thrilling time to be writing fiction, but also definitely to be reading it.
Very quickly before I let you go, if somebody wants to try birding, do they need any equipment besides maybe their phone and eBird? Do they need the fancy binoculars?
Absolutely not. The binoculars can be an investment for later, but all you need is just to go outside, walk around, and just look up.
Kevin Wen is features editor at The Verge, where you can read his article, A Once-in-a-Lifetime Bird. His novel, which is out in paperback this summer, is called New Waves. Kevin, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for spending this time with us.
Yeah, this is so much fun. Thanks, Chris.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think, and the podcast is available wherever you get podcasts if you search for KERA Think and subscribe. You can also catch up on what you've missed at our website and find out about upcoming shows we're planning at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.